Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Today is Thursday, August 13th, 2020. This was another requested broadcast from a parent, so I'm bringing that to you with this in mind, with that in mind. And actually, where I would like to start tonight is something that might feel like it's a little bit off or different, but I'll weave it back in as we go. And it's something that I made up for social media today, just this afternoon. I was thinking about this in the context of therapy. I was thinking about this. I was listening to the news today about how the second wave of the pandemic could be considered a mental health, or it might be a mental health crisis in our country, and that people are really suffering right now. And I was thinking about that idea and how much trauma is out there and how much we're all carrying. And I was thinking about my own consumption of news and social media. In fact, I haven't been listening to the news much at all lately. Yesterday was an exception to it. And this idea came to me about trauma and the internet, or even what's going on broadcast cable or network news. I wrote this today. I wrote, if you are watching the news or you're a purveyor of social media, you are consuming people's trauma. And then I go on to say, many use the internet, social media, as a place to express their frustration, pain, and anger. These feelings are valid and understandable, yet this medium for expression may be causing consumers mental health issues. If we consume social media, it is important to understand we are holding others' trauma, and this comes at an emotional cost to the consumer. And I'll weave this back into the topic of tonight, which is how to bring joy back into the family. I don't think we really even consider this. I don't think we realize how much trauma is being expressed through media and social media outlets right now. And in fact, some of us think it's probably even an obligation, given the things that are going on in our country, to educate ourselves and familiarize ourselves with what's going on in people's voices, and to take in as much information as we can with all the various dilemmas that our society, that our culture is struggling with right now. And while that might seem like an innocent idea, or maybe even a virtuous idea, what I realize as a therapist and a parent educator is that, like I say in these posts, that you really are taking in people's trauma. People ask therapists all the time, how do you do this job? How do you take on people's pain and trauma so much? Listen to people hour after hour, week after week, month after month, year after year. How do you take that on and not have it really be something that costs you a great deal? And of course, the answer is you develop a kind of a muscle, is one thing. But the next thing is you also have to learn in this process when to step away. I remember back in the early days of our program years ago, we would have our clinical meeting on the night after everybody was leaving the field, somewhere in the evening on Wednesday evening, because most therapists on most weeks go out Tuesday morning, spend all day Wednesday, and then are going home on Wednesday evening. So we would have our Wednesday evening clinical meeting to debrief, and everything was fresh in that moment. And what I noticed about those meetings years ago was that there was a lot of humor, of sarcasm, of venting. Everybody was really just letting a lot out in this meeting. And as I watched it and observed this happening over the course of months and years, I realized this was the expulsion, if you will, of the trauma that they had just been holding on to for a couple of days. You know, even our humor got quite dark during those meetings because we were holding on to so much pain, so many wounds over the course of our field week, our field days. So as I've grown in this process, both as a therapist and a parent educator, learning to step away has been an important part of it. And if I don't, and if because of fear or guilt or some sense, some unconscious obligation, if I think I need to stick to it and listen to more and take more on, I really do pay the price for it. My self-care, the way that I treat myself, think, the way that I even treat my family is part of the cost. So while that post that I shared with you might not be fit right into the thick part of what we're talking about tonight, I thought it was relevant in the sense that I think that there are aspects of our behavior at play that we're not quite aware of that affect our happiness and our joy. Here's the basic premise for tonight's broadcast. And again, the title of the broadcast is How to Bring Joy Back into the Family Life. I wrote this today. Letting the joy back in will mean that all the other feelings must come with it. Pain, sorrow, sadness, hurt, anger, etc. They come as a package. That for us to experience deep and profound joy, really it's about learning to feel everything. Because you can't cut out joy because it's connected to our pain. You can't cut out the point pain without sacrificing the joy because the pain is connected to the joy. Joy is more than just happiness. Joy has a feature to it that also has serenity to it, like a peace. It's more of a lasting, consistent base or foundation, whereas happiness might just be happy in a moment. At least that's the way that I'm talking about it this evening. I'm not trying to say that that's everybody's definition of it. I want to read to you a couple of poems this evening because I think they illustrate this idea of how our pain, our sadness, our sorrow, our grief, our loss, our anger, our hurt is connected to our joy. And this is on a poem, of course, by Khalil Gibran, taken from The Prophet. And the title of this is On Joy and Sorrow. And he says this, he says, "Then a woman said, speak to us of joy and sorrow. And he answered, your joy is your sorrow unmasked. And the selfsame well from which your laughter rises was oft-times filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven? And is not the lute that soothes your spirit the very wood that was hollowed with knives? When you are joyous, look deep into your heart, and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that is giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight. Some of you say, joy is greater than sorrow, and others say, nay, sorrow is greater. But I say unto you, they are inseparable. Together they come, and when one sits alone with you at your board, remember that the other is asleep upon your bed. Verily, you are suspended like scales between your sorrow and your joy, and only when you are empty are you at standstill and balanced. When the treasure keeper lifts you to weigh his gold and his silver, he must needs must your joy and your sorrow rise or fall." I think this idea of this broadcast this evening about recapturing joy in our family really does speak at the heart of mental illness and mental health and well-being. Really does, for me, speak at the heart of the goal of therapy, which is for each individual person to become all of themselves. I will say this very clearly tonight. It's very personally my own opinion. And while I hear many other people speak differently of this concept that I'm about to share, I'm just telling you this is my own opinion. I don't have success practicing gratitude and joy. I don't. I'm not able to. It doesn't work for me to focus on my joy and my gratitude as a practice. I hear for many, many people that works for them. What works for me is to feel everything. When I was, and I'd say it happened in my 40s most profoundly, when I was able to embrace more of myself, more of my pain, when I was able to face and confront my fear, my guilt, and my shame and kind of own and do battle with all of it, the gratitude and the joy just came along with it. It was in those moments I was trying to feel happy that I caused myself the greatest amount of suffering. In fact, Buddhists teach this idea that suffering, which the Buddhists will suggest is unnecessary. Pain is inevitable, they suggest, but suffering is not necessary, something we can avoid. What they suggest is that suffering comes when we try to be somewhere that we're not, feel something that we don't, when we pay attention to what how things should have been or should be. You know, it's that idea that parents have oftentimes in my work, which is we're off track. I used to say for years at the beginning of a family presentation, I would say, just for this hour or two, I'll invite you to consider the idea that you're not off track. This is not a detour, that this is exactly where you need to be. And what we learn from that kind of thinking is that if we pay attention to what is, instead of hoping for, wanting for, really kind of reaching for what should be, how life should be, that if we pay attention to what is, we get along with that, focus all the treasure, all the joy, all the lessons that that part of our journey has to offer. But that there is unnecessary suffering in this lack of accepting what is. I wanted to share something else with those of you that are watching tonight. In fact, I'll just read it to you because I wasn't able to post it on your slides that you're watching for this evening. It's a similar kind of poem also from Khalil Gibran on pain. He says this, he says, "And a woman spoke, saying, tell us of pain. And he said, your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Even as the stone of the fruit must break, that its heart may stand in the sun, so you must know pain. And could you keep your heart in wonder at the daily miracles of your life, your pain would not seem less wondrous than your joy. And you would accept the seasons of your heart, even as you have always accepted the seasons that pass over your fields. And you would watch with serenity through the winters of your grief. Much of your pain is self-chosen. It is the bitter portion by which the physician within you heals the sick self. Therefore, trust the physician and drink his remedy in silence and tranquility. For his hand, though heavy and hard, is guided by the tender hand of the unseen. And the cup he brings, though it burn your lips, has been fashioned with the clay that the potter has moistened with his own sacred tears." Again, it's a poem, but it speaks to, very poetically, it speaks to the necessity for us to embrace all. And like I said, and I will make clear before the end of this broadcast, that it is the attempt to not feel pain or sorrow that is the root, the beginning of mental illness and addiction. I'll say that again, that our attempts to not feel our pain, avoid, run away from our pain and our sorrow and our sadness, it is that idea, that energy, that is the root of mental illness in our lives and in our families' lives, and eventually what we pass on to our children, if we do. So let's talk about some principles in recapturing joy in our lives. Like I said, the opposite of recapturing, the opposite of this idea of embracing everything is the beginning of mental illness. I mean, think about it. Heroin, which is basically morphine, is an attempt not to feel pain. And it's so powerful chemically in our bodies that people who become addicted to a drug like heroin, for example, or alcohol or sex or anything, people who are seeking out happiness and pleasure in this unbalanced way, that they'll be willing to do anything, violate their own moral codes, their own integrity. I think what we can offer each other is to sit with each other in our unsolvable problems and our pain. I was talking to my wife the other day, she's a therapist, and we were discussing things that we encounter in therapy, and I was describing a specific dilemma of one of my clients, which had to do with being a woman, of which I have no experience. And I said to my wife, it's really, those are the easiest sessions for me. When somebody expresses, experiences, and shares with me some pain that I have no experience with, because I'm not even tempted to offer a solution, a trite answer to what for them is a deep and unsolvable problem. And the problem with our culture, with stigma and with shame, is we separate ourselves from each other. And it is in and through our pain that we often find connection. It's why I say my most spiritual moments in my life are when I'm sitting in a room with others, when they're sharing their pain and people are listening and connecting to it. For me, that's the closest to the divine that I ever experience. So we learn to sit with each other in our unsolvable problems and our pain. And what that looks like in real time is it looks like listening. It looks like not fixing. It looks like, I use this phrase to illustrate it, it looks like trying not to be helpful, to not give answers. It looks like just pure presence and listening. Like I said earlier, if practicing joy and gratitude worked for you, great, that's fantastic. It doesn't work for me in my process. Because for me, what my ear hears when somebody says practice gratitude is to try to feel something that I may not be feeling that day. For example, I lost my father earlier this year due to COVID. He died from COVID. And so if I was feeling sad and lost that day and somebody said practice gratitude, for me, it would rob me of whatever I was feeling. If my child is struggling and I'm leaning into and feeling the pain of his or her struggle, and somebody says practice gratitude, what my ear hears is don't feel what you're feeling. So if it works for you, fantastic. If it's a kind of a meditation and a focus for you that works, go for it. But I'm giving you another way, permission for another way. It really is akin to mindfulness. In fact, I was on a local show here a few Thanksgivings ago, and we were talking about this idea of gratitude. And what I was saying and sharing was that the holiday, it was around Thanksgiving. I said that the holiday for me is about mindfulness. It's about taking a moment. I was diagnosed, some of you know, I've shared this openly, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis 3 or 4 years ago. And for about 6 weeks, it was in a pretty sad place, a pretty deep funk, hopeless place. And I allowed myself to lean into it. I didn't try to not feel it. And I kept going to therapy and doing my work. And after a month and a half or so, I had a sense of gratitude for my life and for living and for my body that I've never had before. I remember sitting at an intensive some time ago during a meditation at our labyrinth. I remember it was a little bit cold. And I remember feeling the coldness on my toes, which is where my MS manifests in my hands and my feet very often. And I remember feeling the coldness in my toes, which I find to be relatively unpleasant. But that day, because of my MS diagnosis, I was grateful that I could feel it. Got grateful that I could feel anything. I shared this story, but in the face of tonight's topic, I want to go back and share it again, and I think it's profound. I have a dear friend who worked with us for us for many years. And many years ago, almost 20 years ago, he and his wife had a child who had an illness, a very rare illness, where her skin didn't attach itself to itself. And when she would bump up against things or even touch it, it would bleed and scar radically. And she had it from birth. And the doctor said she would live to be about 12 on average. And I remember hearing that news at the birth. He was working for us at the time, and it was heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking. Fast forward around 12 years later, he wasn't working for us anymore. He'd moved on to somewhere else. And I bumped into a mutual friend at a professional conference. And I said to my dear friend, who happens to be a practicing Buddhist, a very inspirational person, I said to my dear friend, I said, have you seen our friend's posts lately on social media? He was sharing in his posts about the last days of his daughter's life as it was coming to an end. And my friend said, yes, I've seen it. And I said to him, I take screenshots of it and I read a little bit at a time because it was long. And I said, it's just a lot of pain. And he looked at me curiously, kind of perplexed. And he said, why do you do that? I said, it's just too much pain. Norman is his name. And then Norman said to me, yes, but the pain that you feel means that you're alive. And you're not going to be alive forever. And I realized, and that really hit me and sank into me. And I thought, you know, I'm not. I'm 52 now. And it's gone by in a blink. And if all goes well, I'm here for another 30 or 40 years. I know that'll go by in a blink too. And what Norman offered me was this idea that to embrace my pain was to embrace life. To embrace living and the joy that comes with it. And so just by that little thought, that little suggestion, invitation, he turned my sorrow, he connected it to my joy and to the love that I feel. So mindfulness is the opposite. I'll share this story also because I think it's just powerful. In my earlier days, in my 40s, I ran marathons, several marathons and a couple of Ironman triathlons and several shorter triathlons. And I had the chance during another professional conference of bumping into a friend who ran ultra races, 200 miles at a time. And so I took the opportunity. I was right in the middle of all of my training and my work. And I said to him, I said, what tips do you have? We had lunch together. So what tips do you have? And the thing that stood out, he said, if you have an injury, really what he said is if you have a pain, lean into it, focus on it. Focus on your pain. He said, if it's an injury, you're going to need to stop and attend to it. But if it's not an injury, it'll go away. He said, if you favor it, you will get injured. That's for sure. And sometime after that, I was running a marathon. And I knew it was tenuous because I was having some problems with my calf at the time. I'd had an injury during an Ironman and it was kind of lingering over the course. So I started the race reluctantly, and sure enough, at mile 4 or 5, my calf started acting up and I felt a tremendous pain in it. And I tried what he said. I had little hope actually that I was going to be able to finish. And I focused on my calf. I didn't favor it. I ran just the same and focused and concentrated on my pain. And around mile 7 or 8, it just disappeared. And I finished the race with my fastest time ever of a marathon. I remember I was talking to a friend. I was sharing with him a new song from a mutual friend of ours, a very sad song. And my friend, upon listening to the song for the first time, said, why does he sing about sad things? And I said, I think he was sad when he wrote it, probably. That's my guess. And I said, I think that's just part of what he does, is he writes, that's part of his expression, his art. There is an idea in all of these stories, this idea that when we lean away from pain, when we go away from our pain, when we try to ignore it or anesthetize it or dismiss it or run away from it, that's when we end up with the injury or the mental illness. So what do? We learn to lean into the detours, to embrace them, to embrace the mistakes, the struggles, and to see what the struggle is trying to teach us. It's really akin to what Buddhists call radical acceptance and what other faiths refer to as faith. It's an idea that the universe is a kind and loving place, and that what's going on for us is something that we can learn from, that we can make sense out of, that can become a part of the fabric of our life. And the opposite of radical acceptance, the opposite of faith, is resentment, is suffering, is fear. So to bring joy back in our lives, to recapture it, I think we have to do battle with our fear, our guilt, and our shame. We have to face it. We have to confront it. Sit with it. Not avoid it. And that those things that cause us, that trigger us to run away from it, those are the things that get in the way of our joy. As strange as this leap might be, I think it's about healing our codependency. I think for a lot of us, it's letting go of what others think of us. And yes, that includes parents. Interestingly and ironically, one of the things that we try to teach parents at Evoke Therapy programs and their children is that children not be concerned with what their parents think of them. I mean, I know that sounds counterintuitive, but when a child reads a hopes and intentions letter, that first letter that they get in our program, what I say to them when I'm present is, this isn't about whether or not your parents are sad or upset or hurt. That's something to be curious about, to listen to, and to consider. But the fact of the matter is, you're hurting yourself. I don't want you to get better so that your parents can sleep at night. I don't want you to get better so that your parents aren't suffering. I want you to get better so that you're not suffering. Your parents' suffering is their responsibility. Your parents' serenity and joy is their responsibility. And when we load the responsibility for our joy, this is critical. When we load the responsibility for our joy and our serenity on others, specifically our children, we burden them with something that is likely to contribute to mental illness and addiction. So we learn to detach. We learn to let go. We learn to be present with others that we care about and love, and to sit in our non-solving love and presence. And we learn to take care of ourselves. I read that post from social media, not completely gratuitously early on, because we learn to own our limitations. We cannot, you and I, cannot hold on to an indefinite amount of suffering, sorrow, and pain alone. And it's okay to watch a ball game, to dance and be silly. I remember, I'll share this personally. I don't know if this is going to be for other people something that's distasteful, but I'll share it anyway. I grew up in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles area. And as a young boy in Los Angeles, sports were a way that I connected to my uncle, who served as kind of my father. He was my closest father figure in my life, and even my older brother. And so our sports teams, which were the Lakers and basketball, and we lived near Anaheim, so the Angels and baseball, they were a part of my childhood. And I brought that love of sports to my children, especially my older children. And I exposed them to the Lakers, and I exposed them to, you know, early Kobe Bryant when he first joined the league. And we kind of, as a family, kind of we followed Kobe Bryant's career. And it was something we would bond over. The highs and lows of his career became kind of part of our family. In psychology, you might think of it as a transitional object. He became our transitional object, something that we bonded through. In fact, when I woke up on an airplane on the way to New York when he died earlier this year, I had 17 texts from friends and colleagues in my family, including my two older children, talking about how grief-stricken they were at his passing, at his loss. And so for us, it was a very personal thing because it was part of our family connection. Like Angels baseball is for my childhood. Kobe Bryant and the Lakers were for their childhood. It was part of our connection. And I arrived in New York and I was grief-stricken for a couple of days. And my daughter, who's 25 right now, she texted me and she said, there's something that's been helping me if you're interested. And I said, I could use any help you have to give. And she said, I've been watching funny videos of Kobe Bryant. Skits on skit shows that he was, talk shows that he was on, practical jokes and so forth. And so she sent me a couple of links of funny Kobe Bryant scenes. And it was the first time I had some relief from that loss. Right? I connected to the joy of it. I tell you that long story because I needed something. I needed to find a balance in that. I need to feel all of it, and it brought me into balance, and it still brings me into balance in this day. So owning our limitations means that we can't punish ourselves by exposing ourselves to things that become overwhelming, too heavy to bear. Shifting a little bit, this I want to talk about this idea because I think it connects to it. I think it connects to something that we let go of to recapture and bring joy back into our life. I hear people say all the time, there's an idea in our culture that we shouldn't need external validation. People who seek for it, struggle with it, mention this often. And what I suggest to them is something just slightly different. I suggest this, in fact, this is from my book, The Audacity to Be You. I say this, the fact is that external validation is necessary. It is a core human drive need. The key is to find a source or a person who values the authentic self rather than some part object. The key is to find somebody who values all of you, who sees all of you, not just the talented, beautiful, smart, successful person. That's easy to find. But who can see the other side of you, the one who fails, who struggles, who the warts, the bruises, the fallibilities, and who can regard that with as much compassion, acceptance, understanding as the wonderful parts. My two older children, collaborated to create this drawing for the book, The Audacity to Be You. I'll describe it to those of you that are listening to the podcast. The first drawing is of an individual standing there where the world is sending this person messages. The caption says, the world that told me this, and the various things that the world is telling this individual in the drawing is, stop complaining, you're acting crazy, I'm disappointed in you, you're overreacting, don't be selfish, you're too sensitive. The next picture, it shows that same individual and it says, the same world that told me that first thing also told me this. And the captions include things like, don't depend on anyone else's opinion. Love yourself. The only approval you need is your own. I hear parents say this sometimes to their children in letters. Validation has to come from within. When you don't seek or need external approval, you are powerful. And there's a few others there. The third picture is, but it was only until this, where somebody is putting their arm around the individual and says, who you are is okay. And then the last picture is the person saying, who I am is okay. It was only when somebody saw all of me that I came to believe, to internalize the idea that I'm okay. So the key isn't to find rewards for your giftedness. The key is to find people who can see you, who don't know your truth, who don't know any shoulds about you. What are the take-homes? The take-homes that joy and pain are inextricably connected. And in a way, depression, in part, not completely, but depression is the psyche's attempt to block uncomfortable, painful emotions. Depression, definitively speaking, is an absence of feeling, an absence of energy, right? It's an absence of passion, of life in the individual. And part of the therapy included in depression, treating depression, is to get people to feel their pain, their sadness, and their loss. It's like if you imagine a dam at a reservoir. And imagine the idea of damming up the water and trying to keep all of it. Imagine the water has become contaminated with something. So you dam it up to block the poisoned water, the contaminated water, from flowing downstream. Well, we all know the result is that the riverbed dries up and it doesn't get the powerful, important nutrients it needs. Because you can't just block out, using the metaphor of the water in the reservoir, you can't just block out the negative. They're kind of all mixed together, connected. You can't block out the pain, the sadness, and the hurt and keep the joy. So we learn how to feel. We learn how to feel everything, and we teach our children how to feel. That becomes the antithesis, the antidote to mental illness. And the joy comes with it. Find others who can sit with you in your pain. It's really important. Support groups, perhaps other people that are suffering or who have suffered with similar ailments that you suffer with, right? If you're married to somebody with Alzheimer's, go to a group that has the same issue. If you have a child who's an alcoholic or a drug addict, go to a group where other parents are there who have felt the same thing. Connect to others in their unsolvable problems and let them connect to you. And with that will come not happiness, because we're not happiness in those examples, but they'll come the serenity that will start to build up the joy. Find others who can sit with you in your pain. Develop a mindfulness practice. Mindfulness is to feel what is. To be present with yourself. And mental illness or addiction can be understood as an attempt to not be present in your own life. Surround yourself with others who don't know what you should do. It's really important. Really, really important. By extension, try to be a person who doesn't know what other people should do. If you want to know what those people sound like, go to an Al-Anon meeting and listen. Go to a Codependents Anonymous or a Families Anonymous meeting. Come to a support group at Evoke, led by one of our therapists. Surround yourself and be one of those people who doesn't know what others should do. And find people who value all of you, who value the mistakes, the limitations, the weaknesses, who can honor and love all parts of you, not just the wonderful, beautiful, talented parts. We all know the emptiness that comes from being admired for only our strengths. In fact, there's a tenuous kind of fear and anxiety in that person because they're afraid, what happens when I get old? What happens if I fail? What happens if you find somebody who's smarter than me? That's the tenuousness of the journey. All right, happy to take any questions. Can you make practical examples of how to teach our children to feel? Great question. Listen, I will pull something up. I think I can do this. I don't know if I can do this. Let's see if I can do this. Here are the practical examples, right here on the screen. It's in my book, The Audacity to Be You. And it's saying things like, thank you for telling me. Tell me more. I appreciate knowing. I'm glad you told me. Thank you. Thanks. That sounds hard. I am sorry. I'm here listening. You're not alone. That makes sense. Is there anything I can do? You must have a good reason for your behavior. I'd like to understand. What can I do to support you? I can relate. Or just being silent. Contrasted with these phrases, which do the opposite. That's silly. You're overreacting. You're too sensitive. You're scaring me. You're being selfish. You should dot, dot, dot. Don't pay them any mind. They're just jealous. Ignore them. You'll get over it. Look on the bright side. Why did you do that? Have you tried this or that? Or that's just your depression, your insecurity, your anxiety, your narcissism. That's just the defense for your rationalization or justification. Right? That's practically what it sounds like. Letting them feel. Leaning into it with them. Somebody says, can antidepressants cut you off from important feelings? Some people complain about that. It's person to person. But I've heard many people complain that antidepressants make them feel numb. Now, if the depth of your depression is suicidal and non-functioning, you might take that, cutting off the sharp edges of the negatives as well as the positives. It's very personal, but I have heard many clients complain about the fact that while depression takes away the lows, but it also takes away the highs. Right? So it's a personal thing, and talk to your, hopefully you have a good psychiatrist who's willing to have a complex dialogue with you, and you're doing therapy at the same time, so that you're paying attention to what works for you. Great question, though. Maybe it sounds like maybe you've had some experience with it, or love somebody who's had some experience with it. Is that all the questions for tonight? I'll go to the other slides and then we can go back to questions. If you want to do a deep dive, we have online intensives and in-person intensives coming up. Go to our website or email intensives@evoketherapy.com. The next in-person intensive with special COVID safety measures, including testing of everybody a day before, is September 16th. That's our next in-person intensive. We also have online intensive, which I have been extraordinarily impressed with. The next one is September 25th. If you want to do a Finding You Too online, that's September 23rd. And then we have a new one, Embracing You, which is exclusively for women of color. Exclusively. In fact, it's 3 days. I have 4 days on there, but that's a typo. So it is led by women of color, and it is for women of color only. And that's September 30th. For more information, go to intensives@evoketherapy.com. Email intensives@evoketherapy.com. We have Pursuits Adventure Trips in Utah and all over the world, anywhere from 3 to 30 days. Contact Sarah without the H, S-A-R-A, at evoketherapy.com. That also can be used for in-between wilderness in the next step if it's appropriate clinically for your family. Parent support groups coming up. August 20th is our next alumni support group for wilderness clients, and our next alumni group for intensive clients is September 8th. Contact Malia at evoketherapy.com for more information. We ask all parents to attend at least 6 12-step support groups, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, Adult Children. You can also use Refuge Recovery or NAMI.org as resources for yourself. All of these broadcasts are available on your favorite podcast app. Just search Finding You and Evoke Therapy Podcast, or you can go to SoundCloud.com to listen from your computer. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find at Evoke Therapy. You can find us using the handle at Evoke Therapy or the handle at Evoke Therapy Intensives on Twitter and Instagram. On Facebook, you can search for Evoke Therapy Programs, or you can find the Family Foundation, which is an organization of alumni families that helps people that can't afford therapy or programming. Go to evokefamilyfoundation.org. We need more. We need new energy in these groups. We always need new money to help support people that can't afford therapy, but they're also looking for board members. And then the Evoke Therapy blog also is a great source of new content each week. My two books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, are available on Amazon. Journey of the Heroic Parent is available also on Audible. And the Audacity to Be You audiobook version will be out very shortly, any day. I'm just waiting to hear and have approval. All right. Somebody says, feel all of it, all the feelings. That seems way too hard. I am not confident I can contain all of them, not even with all the work I'm trying to do. How do you get there? How long does it take? I would love to model that practice for my children. Thank you for saying that. It's not perfection. It's a practice, right? Mindfulness is not perfection. It's a practice. Participating in therapy, all of this work it's a life's work. How long does it take? You'll never arrive. I mean, that is part of the beauty of it, is you'll never arrive. And so just in the meantime, find your people. Find your people who are doing this work. Find your people who don't have easy answers or simple suggestions. Find your people that can sit with you as you're still struggling. Importantly, find people that are able and willing and eager to connect with you in this work. All right. We'll send out an announcement for the next podcast. Malia tells me the next webinar is Tuesday, August 18th at 7 p.m. It's going to be a Q&A for families. So next Tuesday, August 18th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, it'll be a Q&A. Any question left over? Any question, you can invite your family members and friends. We're happy to take them. I hope this is a helpful point of contact for you. Thank you on behalf of your children and your loved ones for attending and listening in. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you next Tuesday. Take care. Bye-bye.
should.